Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Verdict Academy. I am beyond thrilled, grateful, and happy to have esteemed national trial attorney Christopher J. Beeman join us today. And not only is he an esteemed national trial attorney, he's also my very good friend. So thanks for joining us, Chris.
Happy to be here. Can't wait to get going here.
Well, I need to tell the audience about all your awesome accolades for just a minute or two, because there's so many, it may take me a moment, but Chris is a member of what I call the Big Four, which is the four invitation-only elite trial organizations, which consists of ABOTA, ISOB, the International Society of Barristers, the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, and of course, the American College. And Chris, not only is he a member of those organizations, usually a leader of them. For example, he led our San Francisco chapter as president a few years back. He was the National ABOTA Foundation president 2 years ago?
I think so, 2023, right.
There you go, 2 years ago. And raised a record amount of money for the foundation, which helps fund all of its educational programs, which is so important to preserve the Seventh Amendment. He has been awarded our chapter's highest honor, which is the Don Bailey Civility Award, along with his best bud and our mutual friend, Rich Schoenberger, a couple years ago. He teaches and lectures in trial advocacy across the Bay Area. He's also an awesome person. He's a great cyclist, great swimmer, and has a terrific family. And if you don't like Chris, you're going to love his wife, Jill, who's become my friend too. So welcome, Chris Beeman.
Yes, looking forward to catching up with you, KMO. Oops, there goes your nickname.
Whoa, oh no, cat's out of the bag. By the way, I was looking at your CV or your bio this morning, and I thought I knew you pretty well, and I was shocked to learn that you were on the dean's list in law school. Are you sure they got the right grades and the right transcript matched up with the right name?
So let the ripping begin at the outset of our podcast. Yes, I did. I went to Santa Clara, which I really enjoyed going to school there. It was an awesome place to go to law school after I came out here from the Midwest. And there must have been lower standards then because, yeah, I was a dean's list guy.
So Chicago boy, born and raised Chicago, Notre Dame, big Fighting Irish fan. And then you moved out to Santa Clara to go to law school. What brought you out to California?
Well, it was chasing a woman. It was short-lived. But it's interesting how I rounded out my education with a Jesuit law school. And again, I just can't say enough about Santa Clara. I think I've hired about 30 or 40 lawyers from Santa Clara since I graduated in 1985. But I went to a Dominican high school in Chicago, Fenwick High School. And then Notre Dame is a Brothers of the Holy Cross College. And of course, Santa Clara is a Jesuit institution. So I have the trifecta of Catholic education, and if that counted for anything, I might be able to get into heaven, but I think I got an uphill battle there.
I think you missed the Franciscans, but there's always a chance in the future to get involved somewhere. Let's get into the meat of the podcast, and you know, the podcast is designed basically for younger trial attorneys to hear from the veterans and what they need to know for trial, because as you know, there are fewer and fewer trials these days, are more expensive, harder to get out. And we've had the benefit, and certainly you have, of how many cases have you tried to verdict, Chris?
I think somebody just asked me that yesterday, and I think I've tried about 65. I've tried cases with multiple plaintiffs, so I've tried cases brought by more than 100 plaintiffs, but the actual lawsuits are probably around 65 jury trials. It's been a good run. It's something that I know we're going to get into that I think is worth saying at the outset. Is that, you know, even having tried that many cases, there's still a great deal of energy, anxiety, and not fear, but the preparation for trial and the buildup to trial still brings a lot of excitement after all those trials. And that's kind of one thing that keeps lawyers at our age and grade going, because it's still a great competition and still has a lot of thrill to it, I would say, even after all these trials.
You're definitely a competitor and you're a natural storyteller. What drew you to trial law? What made you think, you know what, this is for me?
Well, kind of going back to Chicago, I first was introduced to the practice of law when I worked at a big law firm in Chicago. It's called Kirkland & Ellis. When I worked there in the summer, I was a runner. So I basically worked in the mailroom. And it was really cool. I saw a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff. I delivered documents. This was way before fax or email or anything else. And kind of got to at least see the behind-the-curtain stuff that was going on at that law firm. And it was intriguing enough for me to think, huh, that would be kind of cool. And I went to undergraduate in Indiana and decided that it would be good to spread my wings a little bit and move away from the Midwest to try law school. So as I mentioned before, I came out here in the early 80s to Santa Clara. I really, really enjoyed the torts class. I think that might have been the first class I ever attended. And the professor was Alan Shefflin. He was a really interesting guy, great storyteller, and made it really interesting. So I kind of immediately engaged in tort. I loved some other courses, including, believe it or not, I love civil procedure and evidence were two other great courses. So I started to see, I didn't have a love for trust and estates and didn't find it interesting and thought wills was really boring. And I eventually got into moot court and thought, this is fun. Because, you know, now we're going at it just like playing basketball against my friends growing up and whatever else we did to stay occupied. But the competition part of it definitely was what really drew me, because I always say life is a competition. I mean, just about everything we do is a competition. And this was a way to, you know, make a living while also competing and hopefully winning. That's always more fun than losing. So that's how I got drawn into this trial work that we do.
And you've been with the same firm your whole career, right? Clapp Maroney?
I have. I'm not sure if that makes me smart or stupid, but it's been good to me. I've got some great opportunities as a young lawyer. And one of the things about our firm is that we do try a lot of cases, and we do have, it's kind of a great avenue to get into trial. Started out doing insurance defense work, and still that practice really carried me through 30 years or so until I started to do other things that were tangential to being hired by our insurance companies. But that's a really great way for young lawyers when you're coming out of law school. The two places that you can almost be guaranteed to try cases are the district attorney's office, public defender, insurance defense firms. They try cases. And obviously, plaintiffs firms like yours, like Altair, which is a great firm that I have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, it is hard to get out to trial. So, you know, we're focused on things that help, trial tips basically to help the younger lawyers. I'm a big rule of three guy. And so you've got three topics that you picked out. And the first is trial preparation. What do you want younger trial attorneys to know about trial preparation generally? And how do you prepare for trial?
Well, that's kind of a broad topic, but I did think that that was worth talking about, because one thing that you'll hear over and over again from a jury, from jurors afterwards, because when you finish a trial, usually the judge gives the lawyers an opportunity to interact with the jurors if the jurors are willing to stick around and talk. And something that jurors are usually complimentary about is when the lawyers that are in the courtroom are prepared, because it's really amazing how some aren't. That, I guess that's one of the things about competing. You want to be ready for the game. You want to be ready for the trial, obviously, but it's a long process and it really needs to start early. So I thought if we spent some time talking about that, and I'd love you to chime in and tell me what the plaintiff side does, because I think there's certainly some distinction between the way we approach these cases. But, you know, being a defendant, one of the benefits of getting to trial is that the plaintiffs do go first. So it gives the defense time to continue getting organized. I think we were joking around about this recently, where when it's a defense case, the plaintiff has to worry about all the witnesses and all the stuff up front. And the defense lawyer gets to kind of watch it unfold. And obviously, there's a lot to do with cross-examination and such. But it's still, you get to kind of lie in wait a little bit for your side to come. But going back to the prep for trial, I think people all have heard by now many times that the first thing, or one of the very first things you need to do, which is both practical and also helps guide what you're going to do with the defense of the case, is to look at the jury instructions. It's really, I work up cases now with partners and associates, so usually there's a collaboration and a team approach to this. I still always do the jury instructions. Even though my partners could do a great job on them, I really like to do them so that I'm thinking about what's going to be important to develop in the case. So that's pretty simple. But if you go right to Casey, if it's a premises case, you remind yourself what the elements are and what potential defenses you have about notice. And it's really a good way to kind of engage early, as looking at the law and thinking about how you're going to prove your affirmative defenses or defeat the effort by the plaintiff's lawyer to submit evidence that's going to support their case. So that's a really basic principle, but I think it's really important to do that. And, you know, I don't open a case as soon as a case comes in, especially because some of the cases have common themes or at least common fact patterns that you can rely on your historical knowledge to get going on. But eventually you crack that case and say, okay, which of these instructions is going to be important in this case?
And the use notes too, I tell my younger, like the use notes are huge, so important.
Right, totally. It's funny because that always comes up when we're arguing whether the instructions are applicable or whether the judge is going to give the instructions. So I have to admit, even though, as you noted earlier, I was on Dean's list, I don't always read the use notes until we get right into the chamber's conferences about giving instructions. But that's one, I think the instructions are a great way to, you know, get the roadmap for what you need to get going on in the case. The other things, these are, you know, I think fairly basic ways to approach getting ready for trial, but, you know, putting your team together is really important. And I do try to have consistency in the people that are helping me with discovery. And I'm very fortunate. I've worked with my friend, Kevin Dessler, who's paralegal in our office for almost my entire career. In fact, for my entire career. So we have a very good system about getting organized.
What's his email address? I could use somebody.
Yeah, he is not available, I hope, if he ever listens to this, but he's always been a great support. I think we've tried every case together. I can't think of a single one. And that's really helpful from a comfort standpoint and from a just routine standpoint. Just like getting a jury consultant, you and I were talking to one of the jury consultants that you used just a few weeks ago at the Altair party, and she was actually highly complimentary of Kevin Morrison's ability to pick a jury, which was, I thought, impressive. And
I have paid her a fair amount of money over the years, so, but yeah.
I try to engage a jury consultant early, if depending on the exposure and, you know, the expenses and the client's authority to do that, which is something the defense has to deal with probably a little bit more than the plaintiff's side of things, because we have to ask for permission for a lot of stuff and get our client to commit to paying it. That's another important cog for me, because jury consultants obviously have seen lots of different kind of cases and can help with themes and certainly with the selection of the actual jury, which I think we're going to talk about. But putting together a team and hopefully having a cohesive team that communicates regularly about what needs to be done to get the case ready, that's a very useful tool to have. And, you know, getting the cases ready themselves, once you have your team lined up and kind of get a, you understand the law, then you have to conduct the discovery, which I think is probably a whole other chapter that we don't need to go in today. But, you know, how you start with the discovery, whether you take the plaintiff's deposition early or later, depending on if it's a TBI case where maybe the plaintiff will get better over time and you want to wait, or when the IMEs are done and you have plaintiffs examined by different kind of medical professionals, that all depends on where the case is, who the plaintiff's lawyer is, where it's venued, all those factors that really kind of impact how you're going to prepare the case. And let's face it, most cases settle. So you're preparing the case for trial with the likelihood that it's going to resolve. But I think it almost goes without saying that if you don't prepare a case for trial, then it will go to trial.
100%. 100%. Yeah. On trial prep, and we're going to get to jury selection in a second. I'm glad you made that segue, but you parachute in a lot of cases, which means, you know, the case is worked up by their firm and the defendant says, you know what, we want an actual trial attorney to this case. So you get the case. So it's in the box, right? A lot of the depths are done. Maybe expert discovery is done. What do you want to see first when you're parachuting in a case?
Well, chewing somebody else's gum is usually uncomfortable, but it is something that we do often. And, you know, and sometimes you get a case that's in great shape and you go, these are all the questions I need in this expert deposition. And sometimes you get a case where the expert depositions aren't even taken yet, or it's too late to take them. So there's all a great variety of what kind of shape the file is in. We take, you know, it's funny, and I want to say the plaintiff's lawyers are able to be a little bit more selective typically in which client they're going to accept than defense lawyers. I mean, that's not always true, but I think as a rule of thumb, it does seem to work that way. So if we're parachuting into a case, usually it's because there's some desperation or some lack of confidence or some problem. So that can be a little unsettling, but you go in blind. So you say, yeah, sure, we'll jump in. And then you get the file and you look at it and you go, holy shit, what have I done? Why did we do this? But what we're looking for there, I mean, you always have to start with the plaintiff, right? That's you really want, especially hopefully it's videotape deposition, and you can get a real feel for how that person is going to come across to the jury. Because, you know, I mean, I think the most important things when you're evaluating or trying a case are easy to recognize. One is, who's the plaintiff's lawyer? You know, when I always look at the pleadings immediately to see if I recognize the plaintiff's lawyer, and if so, whether he or she is a trial lawyer or somebody who maybe doesn't try cases, because that'll affect certainly the settlement value and also how you approach the case. The other thing that I've mentioned already is eyeballing the plaintiff is critical to understanding what you're going to do. Is it somebody the jury is not going to like? Is it somebody the jury will think is embellishing or not being accurate with the facts? And you can get a little bit of a sense for that just by watching the video deposition, body language, their demeanor. So that's, I think, a real critical place to start. The other thing that's obviously important in terms of what's going to happen in trial is, who's your judge? You know, have you been in front of the judge before? Is it a judge that you're comfortable with? Is it too late to challenge the judge, which usually it is? But those are the things that we're looking at when we first put our toe into a case that we're parachuting in to try.
Got it. So let's move to jury selection. We talked a little about it a little already. Is this the most important single part of trial to you, picking the jury?
I think it is, because what you're doing is you're creating the audience for your narrative. So you're looking for an audience that is receptive to your story, or at least that will be fair, right? So it's a process that, and I know you both, you really like this too. I think this is probably, I guess lawyers like different things. I love cross-examination. I really love closing arguments, but my favorite part is jury selection. And I think we both have said, getting to know jurors is an enjoyable process. You know, it doesn't always go the way you want it to. Something you mentioned, Rich Schoenberger, who's somebody that we both admire and like a lot. And I'll talk about him for a second, because I've watched him pick a jury and he has a remarkable memory. He's very, very good with the names of the jurors without looking at notes. He's just got the ability to kind of capture that. And his style, which I think this is the style that works for most of us, I think you and me and Rich for sure, is, you know, to have a conversation with the jury and to feel what they're feeling. That is really to get to understand how they're seeing general concepts of the law. And it is a little bit of a delicate balance. You know, we're kind of toeing the line on explaining some of the facts because we can't get them indoctrinated too much to the facts, but we do want to talk about those. So that's a process that I don't know if it comes naturally. Oh, I meant to say, this is what I was going to say about Rich. He actually practices his jury selection, which I think is really interesting. And, you know, has people, when he's working with a jury consultant, they have a panel and he actually goes through different responses, reactions to what people tell them, which I think is a really interesting and kind of novel, for me at least, way to do that. That's not something that I do. Do you do that, Kimo?
I do, actually. If I'm rusty, meaning if I haven't tried a case in a year, I like to do a mock pick and an opening with, you know, 12 to 15 people in a focus group type situation. It just gets the rust out. And yeah, I think it's really helpful.
Yeah, that's it. I'm learning something from this podcast by listening. I am intrigued by that. So maybe next time around.
I've never not learned something. I mean, just the phrase of something, or I've always learned something that's always, it's a pain in the butt because it's the weekend or two before trial. You're busy as hell. You got all these motions and the garbage, as I like to say, the minutia, the distractions. But it is so critical. I think it is the most important part of trial. And I always learn something and improve our chances. Back in a jury, do you just want to figure out if they're a leader or where they're, if they're open to the defense case? Because of course the plaintiff's attorney gets to go first and maybe you spend an hour with them. And let's assume that plaintiff's attorney is a good guy or a good person, has made a decent impression. So you get up and now you get to go, which is a challenge, right? So what are you looking for? Are you kind of going off what the bad answers from your perspective are? Are you just trying to make sure they're open to hear two sides? What are your goals in jury selection?
Well, first, I want to plug my jury consultant, Andrew Walker from Cogent. And I've worked with him for about 10 years or maybe more. And we have a good system with, I think, he's extremely organized, very helpful. They do great background and social media searches and such on the veneer. And I think I said the right
word. Sounds good to me. Jury panel? I call it jury panel.
certainly since the pandemic, Every case I've tried has had a jury questionnaire.
Do you like those, by the way?
I do. I mean, you know, it's more information, and I think it does make our or dire more pointed, because you can learn the general stuff without having everybody tell you it. You can read it.
My theory on this real quick is people are always going to be honest when they're by themselves writing something down. But those that like, when you have to speak in front of a big group, a lot of people just don't like doing that. And they'll shade their comments because they'll think, well, I better not say this because he'll think this.
I agree. And I think that it is, you can find stuff. And this is when it's really helpful to have a trial team, because what we typically do is, the last case I tried with my partner, Ashley Myers, and she's got her own unique perspective. She's younger than I am, and obviously comes from a little bit of different background. So we had our jury consultant, Andrew, paralegal, Kevin Dessler, and then my partner, Ashley, and I, each reviewing the jury questionnaires. And everybody finds kind of different things in the jury questionnaires. So, you know, that's a huge organizational task. I was just in Marin County, and we were going to have two panels, which would have been ended up resolving. So we didn't do that. But, you know, staying organized in jury selection is hugely important and critically important. And so what we're looking for is, obviously, that's really one of your only opportunities to make a first impression. Depending on whether you've done a mini opening, that would be your very first. But if it's a statement of the case that's read, then really jury selection is your first chance to make an impression. So being organized is super important, because juries do not want to sit around watching a lawyer fumble for a note card to figure out what he meant to ask juror number 12. So that's really important. And that's why that's one of the huge values of having a jury consultant that can keep you on track, just with the way they organize their charts and the color-coded system of, you go into the selection with some rating system of the jurors that are out there, you know, based on their questionnaires, whether they seem like they're your kind of a juror. And then, you know, what you're doing, you hit one of them as you're trying to determine leaders and the strength of the juror and which tendency the juror might be showing during the questioning process. And there are defense profiles that we look for typically, you know, it depends on the facts of the case and who the plaintiff is, of course, but we're usually trying to find jurors that fit into the slots that we like based on their background, their education level, their income, their leadership. So I don't think I've told any secrets yet, but that's kind of the way we approach it.
And when you're picking a jury, are you yourself taking notes, or are you relying on your team to do that?
A little bit of both. I try not to take too many notes because you can get distracted by doing that. But I take a lot of notes when the judge is doing voir dire and when the plaintiff's lawyer is. I mean, I'm listening and watching. That's when you get the follow-up questions, if you get to that point. And, you know, generally speaking, I always, and I'd be curious to know how you do this, Kevin, but I always talk to the entire, usually it's a six-pack method, although that changes from department to department, but whoever's in the box or we're talking to, I try to talk to everybody first as a collective global audience. And then depending on the patience of the judge and the type of cases, I do try to at least introduce myself and ask a question of each juror if that works. It doesn't always. And in that case, then you just apologize that you're not going to talk to them and hope they don't mind not being on the spot when you're asking them questions.
Yeah, same. I do think it's important to talk to every juror, even if it's like, Mr. Last person and judge, just give me 30 seconds. Is there anything you heard that leads you to conclude that you might not be free? Just to give them, maybe that, you know, they know an uncle or something happened that's dramatic. And every once in a while, it's like, oh yeah, I was a claims adjuster, or my father was killed, or, you know, you learn something about somebody's not talking, which is huge, right? It can be a game changer.
No doubt.
All right, last topic then is closing argument. There's kind of two views on this, I think. One is closing is, first of all, it's super fun to do as lawyers because we like to get up there and strut our stuff. But the jury's kind of fried at this point, right? And so when you're giving a closing, do you think you can swing the entire verdict at that point? Are you trying to throw out some tidbits to your jurors to use? What is your strategy in closing argument?
Well, again, being organized is really important. So I hope I'm not overemphasizing that, but particularly in closing, when, you know, typically the cases that you and I try are long cases, they're complicated, they have a lot of issues. In your case, a lot of times, a lot of plaintiffs. So the energy that you have at the end of trial does begin to wane, depending on how long you've been going at it and what the schedule has been with the judge. But I do think that that's when the adrenaline kind of kicks in, at least it does for me. And then the late nights to get the PowerPoint together and how to organize the evidence and the jury instructions, because that's critical, I think. You know, it's not a big trick, but I've never given a closing argument without having a special verdict that I completed for and with the jury. because, you know, that's something new to them. I always try to get something new going during closing because they've seen the evidence. They've heard usually a lot of testimony. So if you can just refine the important evidence to your case and present it in a way that might be a little different, even if it's they might have heard some important testimony, but if you can either replay their deposition, if that was how the evidence came in, or display on a screen the actual text of their testimony so that that kind of comes to life in a different way for them.
Do you get dailies so you can throw the trial transcript up there, or what do you do with that?
It depends on the case, honestly. I mean, it kind of depends on the exposure and whether we have the ability to do that. I do sometimes do that. One thing I wanted to say is that with technology, obviously people love to learn by looking and seeing things. And that's how I learn myself. I'm a visual learner. But in closing, I try to not get overly tech. You know, low tech can just be just as good as high tech, including I use whiteboard, I use overhead projectors, I use Elmos. And, you know, you don't want to do too many because that gets a little confusing. It's like juggling balls. But I do think that the tendency of people to be married to their PowerPoint in closing is not a good trend. And I try to avoid that myself just because as much as people like to look at stuff, I think it becomes a little rote if everything's on a slide. So I try to change it up in different ways.
Mix it up. Make them pass a photograph around, that kind of stuff. Throw something up on a whiteboard.
You know, we're defense lawyers. I don't think I've ever tried a case that doesn't have a timeline in it. We're very big on timelines, especially when there's medicine involved or some gap of treatment or something. And the jurors, I think, really like when you illustrate that as opposed to talking about it. When you show like, okay, here's 2022 and here are the 10 months where there were no complaints of any residual brain injury symptoms. And here's when he went to see Topher Stevenson after that and all of a sudden had a brain injury. I think those can be very helpful.
Timelines are critical. So we're almost done, believe it or not. I could talk to you all day long and would love to do so. But let me ask you this question. You got a tough liability case. Let's say it's a toss-up. You could defense it, but it's a huge damage case. And the plaintiff's attorney's got a big ask out there, you know, $50 million suggestion or whatever it is in closing. When you get up to close, you think you've got a decent chance to defense it, but it is high exposure. Is it your general philosophy to float a defense number as well after you argue the hell out of the liability, or do you just leave that alone? What's your general philosophy there?
There's a sliding scale to my answer for that. And that is, I think, you know, if you're first, I want to back up and address one other thing. If there's a case of liability and you're not going to win the liability, the decision you have to make is, should we concede that we're negligent and just argue no causation or minimal damages? And that's a decision that we don't take that very lightly, because if you do concede it, obviously you can't argue against it. But at the same time, you can really establish your credibility by lying down on negligence if you're not going to win. If you guaranteed not to win, then you can get the jury to see how reasonable you are by not arguing it. In a tough liability case, what you don't want to lose your credibility on the liability piece of the case, because that could impact whether they believe what you're going to say about damages. So that transition is always really difficult. I mean, almost every time I will go through the special verdict and tell them why they should be answering no to all these questions about negligence and causation and damages. And then basically, at some point, usually about three quarters of the way through, say, you might see the evidence entirely different than the way we perceive it. And we will respect what your decision is. If you believe that damages have been established, that there is negligence and causation, then let us give you another perspective about what the damages, what reasonable damages would be. So I pretty much always give a number. I mean, I don't think there's been too many cases that I've said that the only thing you can do is give a defense verdict, because I think that's really risky. And then there's nothing in the juror's mind about what does that guy think it's worth. And so you want to have an anchor, and you want it to be realistic at that point, because, you know, you're going up somebody against somebody like you. You want to make the jury believe that there are two sides to that story, and they should hear them both.
I'm glad I haven't had to try a case against you, because those pearly whites are awfully dangerous with juries, as we all know. Chris has a phenomenal career. Any parting words to our audience, Chris, of wisdom for young trial attorneys, what they should do or what should they focus on as they build their careers?
Sure. Thanks for having me first. But I would say the takeaways for me are, if you're on the defense side, and you want to try cases, it's really important you set the cases up to get tried. In other words, when you get close to trial, don't change your evaluation. Don't say, oh, I need more money, or oh, my kids have a basketball game this weekend and I don't want to work. You really do need to set the cases up and tell your claims rep, if it's an insurance case, that what the exposure is, and don't waffle on that. I think it's, you have to do your part to get to trial. It's not going to be handed to you. The other thing, and I'd highly recommend this to all young lawyers, is make sure that you have a mentor that is going to help you along in your career. Go watch trials, beg people to get in the chair as a second trial or to take a witness or to do a mini opening. Because once you stick your toe in the water, it's much easier to get in and swim with the sharks. So you just got to get there by setting the cases up for trial, participating in other people's trials so you get the taste of it, and you're off and running.
Awesome. Wise words. Chris Beeman, thank you so much for being on. You're a great trial attorney. Even better than that, you're a great human being and a great friend of mine.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.